From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Calls for New York Governor Andrew Cuomo to resign are growing louder. The New York State Assembly Democrats are meeting today to discuss next steps. And this is after a sixth woman has come forward this week accusing him of sexual misconduct. The anonymous woman works for Cuomo and says she was aggressively groped late last year in the governor's mansion. Let's bring in WAMC's news director Ian Pickus in Albany for more. Hey, Ian.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. So what's the latest you're hearing from state lawmakers today?
Well, the minority Republicans in the state legislature are pretty unified that Cuomo should resign or face impeachment. A new development today was that the Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie, a Bronx Democrat, said that the caucus, the Democratic caucus, would be meeting today to discuss next possible paths forward. Hastie had fallen short of calling Cuomo to resign outright on Sunday in a statement, but today that ground may be shifting a little bit, and the caucus is now discussing the possibility of impeachment, of calling on Cuomo to resign outright, or a new third way that we've heard today, which is maybe Cuomo would step back for a while and the lieutenant governor would take over while the investigation plays out.
Oh, interesting. I want to get to all of those points with you. But first, let's go through this latest allegation. It's one of the most serious against Cuomo. Tell us more about it.
It is. Cuomo had been accused of misconduct, maybe some misbehavior earlier. The Times Union newspaper here in Albany reported that an unnamed woman had come forward. She was an aide to the governor and alleged that she was summoned to the executive mansion late last year, where the governor made a physical pass at her, groped her under her shirt, on the pretense of having been called over there to help the governor with a cell phone. Now, after that report broke, another Cuomo accuser, Charlotte Bennett's attorney, released a statement saying those details were very similar to what Charlotte Bennett had experienced being called to help the governor in a one-on-one setting. Now, the identity of that latest accuser has not been made public yet. And the governor says that the allegations are gut-wrenching, but has not otherwise addressed them.
Okay. So, yeah, he mentioned that all of these allegations are gut-wrenching, but has he responded at all specifically to this latest allegation?
The timing of this is very interesting. He did do a conference call with reporters earlier in the week when he said that he was not aware of the new accusation. It turns out, according to the newspaper, that this was made public, at least within the governor's office, maybe around March 3rd. The governor did release a statement to the newspaper saying that the investigation should be taking a look at that latest allegation. He says that he has never touched anybody inappropriately, and he has repeated that, and you repeated that on the conference call with reporters this week, although the timing of this latest accusation and when the governor was made aware of it is still unclear.
Okay. So what would happen should Cuomo resign or be removed by an impeachment process? Who's next in line?
Well, it's a bit of uncharted waters unless you were around in 1913 when Governor Sulzer was impeached, the last New York governor to be impeached. It's a very complicated process in New York. The short answer is the next in line would be Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul. She's a Democrat from the Buffalo area. She previously served in Congress, and she's been keeping up a number of events this week, although notably hasn't taken many questions. She also released a statement earlier in this latest controversy saying that the investigation should go forward. The claims were serious. But other than that, she has not publicly called on Cuomo to go or given any extended interviews in recent days.
Okay. You know, I have less than a minute with you, but what about public sentiment? How are New York residents feeling about their governor right now?
It's interesting. A Quinnipiac poll earlier in recent days found that a majority of New Yorkers don't want to see Cuomo seek a fourth term, which has long been a goal of the governor's. It would eclipse his father, Mario Cuomo, who fell short at three. A slightly smaller majority also didn't want to see him resign. However, that poll was taken before this latest accusation, which, as you say, is the first one alleging a physical interaction between the governor and an aide.
That's Ian Pickus, WAMC's news director in Albany, New York. Thank you so much for this update.
Thank you for having me.
A growing number of states are expanding coronavirus vaccine eligibility. Starting on Monday, all Texans over the age of 50 can get a shot. And on that same day in Georgia, anyone over 55 Plus, people 16 and older with serious medical conditions will qualify. The state of Alaska has gone even further. This week, it became the first state to make shots available to anyone over 16 years old. Joining us now is Tessa Walker-Linderman. She's a nurse and co-leader of the Alaska Vaccine Task Force. Tessa, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
And the first question is, how and why have you been able to do this?
Well, there's a lot of different factors that played into this decision, but ultimately we have just seen a lot of Alaskans very interested in getting vaccinated. And so we felt that we had enough vaccine that we were able to open up to people 16 and older. And as we worked through the different eligibility criteria that we had, we felt that it was becoming a barrier to people being able to get vaccinated. The language is confusing, and ultimately we just want people to get vaccinated. And so we decided to open it up and have been really thrilled to see Alaskans signing up and getting vaccinated quickly.
Well, did you notice that some of your appointments that you had slotted were going unfilled?
We did see that. We had opened up pretty broadly last week and just felt that our eligibility language was maybe a bit confusing. And so while we felt that many Alaskans were eligible, they weren't sure if they were. And so really by opening it up, we just eliminated that barrier. We are, you know, seeing additional appointments being added regularly as well as production of a vaccine ramps up as well. We're receiving more and more vaccine.
It has been just over a little more than a day now, but what's the response been so far? Are you seeing a rush of young people coming forward to get vaccinated?
We are. I mean, we're really seeing all types. I think for a lot of people, we're seeing all ages, but certainly we're seeing young people. I'm very grateful for those that have been patiently waiting. And I think, until we opened it up more broadly, even people that were eligible felt that they should wait until, you know, the most vulnerable people still could get vaccinated, even though they were already eligible. And so, we are just really grateful to be able to open it up to everyone, because I think we have spent quite a bit of time really trying to reach those most vulnerable, and really we're thrilled with the number of people 65 and older that have been vaccinated. And so being able to open it up to everyone now just really helps keep the protection more broadly statewide.
Well, let's see if we can kind of dig into why Alaska has been so successful here. A quarter of the people in your state have received at least one vaccine dose. That's one of the best vaccination rates in the country. And I also understand that Alaska Native groups have been really good, really effective at getting those shots out. How big of a role has that played in your success, do you think?
I think it's played a huge role in our success. We have partnered with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium really since late summer. The tribes had a choice to receive their vaccine through IHS or have it come through the state. And the tribes in Alaska did choose to have their vaccine come through the state. And so it's really been a joint distribution effort.
Explain that more, because, I mean, anyone who knows Alaska knows that it is incredibly rural, and that is an understatement. How do you get those vaccines out to places where, you know, you have to take an airplane and then you have to probably take a snow machine out even further to get to certain villages? How do you do that?
Well, you know, I think there's lots of different ways this is happening, but I will say that I do think another part of our success is that we are running, you know, a statewide immunization program day in and day out, you know, regardless of COVID or not. And so, you know, our immunization program has certainly, you know, is a well-oiled machine at this point. And so getting vaccine out rurally is something that they have to do in regular time. In really rural Alaska, most of the healthcare is our tribal health system. And so we get the vaccine out to the hubs, and then they have their distribution system. That's how they get their healthcare out to these rural areas normally. And so, you know, certainly small planes, snow machines, you know, there's certainly float planes, ferry rides. We've had a vaccine go out in so many different ways, but it's really based on the backbone of our immunization program that set up the system.
Well, Alaska relies on a seasonal workforce for its tourism industry, which is big there in the state. Are you concerned by expanding eligibility here that people are going to rush in from out of state to get these shots?
We're really putting a big focus and emphasis that this vaccine is for Alaskans, people living and working in Alaska. And so we do really ask that people honor that. And, you know, I think it's because we are a bit isolated. It takes a little bit of effort for people to get up here. It's not that you can drive across state line and sign up for our appointments. It may be an issue, but we are really trusting that people will do the right thing. And, you know, our system so far has been a pretty much an honor system. And we really have seen that people are following that and will continue to stress the importance of it.
Tessa Walker-Linderman is co-leader of the Alaska Vaccine Task Force. Thank you very much for your time and congratulations on that success.
Thank you so much.
Today is March 11th, and we're going to go back in time, back to this day last year, the day the NBA decided to suspend its games and later the entire season, the day the pandemic became real.
Rudy Gobert has tested positive for the coronavirus. Starting tomorrow, NBA play is suspended. This is the last night of NBA games for the foreseeable future.
That clip is from ESPN's new 30 for 30 podcast, aptly called March 11th, which takes us through the realities through the lens of basketball, how we woke up on March 11th to one reality, and by the end of the day, we had all become aware that another reality lay before us. Joining us now is Julia Laurie Henderson. She's a senior editorial producer for the 30 for 30 podcasts, and she joins us now. Julia, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes. So 30 for 30, it is known for its in-depth documentaries about sports and sports figures. This podcast in particular interweaves the experiences of a vast number of people that day, leading us to an NBA game in Oklahoma that was scheduled to happen that evening. You could have focused solely on the NBA, but you decided to take us on a journey through the day. How did you decide to take that approach?
When this idea sort of first came to fruition last summer, I was talking to Ramona Shelburne, who obviously covers the NBA for ESPN. She was the one who sort of first imparted on me, like, this day, this was a turning point. I became really fascinated by what we were waking up to in that morning. What were the headlines? What were the stories that were supposed to be important that ended up being eclipsed by the pandemic declaration and then the suspension of the NBA season and really a whole new reality setting in.
Joe Biden this morning says he's unstoppable.
A good Wednesday to you. Here we go again with another warm day slated across portions of the southern United States.
A duo of Russian pranksters say they duped Prince Harry into believing he was on the phone with climate activist Greta Thunberg and her father.
The stunning twist on the grand finale of The Bachelor.
Julia, what voices in this podcast stand out to you?
I mean, I'm so thrilled that we got to talk to Dr. Fauci. You know, it's not often that someone like Dr. Fauci also touches on a sports story, but it was so fascinating to hear his story of the day, to watch how quickly that all progressed. And there's something so human about the way he tells it. And, you know, when he gets home and he's watching, you know, the presidential address on TV, it felt important to us to be able to hear that voice and to have that side of the pandemic unfurling.
I helped in reviewing the speech. And I got home essentially just in time. But the adrenaline and the energy of having gone head to head with the president, having helped with the editing of the speech, my wife put together some food and a glass of beer. I remember it was Lagunitas IPA. And I sat down, I watched the speech.
My fellow Americans, tonight, I want to speak with you about our nation's unprecedented response to the coronavirus outbreak that started in China and is now spreading throughout the world.
The president's speech was something everyone watched, but the real drama of this new podcast takes place behind the scenes before the NBA game in Oklahoma City. This is where producer Julia Laurie Henderson picks up the story.
The NBA has some protocols in place. The Utah Jazz arrive in Oklahoma City the night before. They have two players who don't feel well. Those players are put into quarantine, and the team lets the NBA know and contacts local public health officials. Emmanuel Mudiay, his tests all come back. He has the flu. So they know what he has. They can deal with that. Rudy Gobert's tests all come back negative, which triggers the next step, which is get him a coronavirus test.
I was in my hotel room in Oklahoma City. I was getting ready to watch my team play against the Thunder. And when I saw that some doctors ran on the floor and stopped the game, that's when I knew that something was going on. And I mean, I was a little nervous. I was waiting to get the call, and a few seconds later, I got the call from the trainer. And he told me that I tested positive.
It's a crazy moment in time. How, you know, we thought there were these precautions. Even the NBA thought there were precautions, and they were ahead of most. You know, there was distance between reporters and the players, and reporters weren't allowed back into the locker rooms, and all of these new things were in place that were, you know, we thought, hoped were enough because we understood so little. But in hindsight, like, they were nowhere near enough.
Word of Gobert's positive test came back about 10 minutes before the Thunder Jazz game was about to tip off. And that triggered a series of rapid-fire conversations between health officials, Thunder owner Clay Bennett, and Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt, who was actually in the arena for the game.
Clay and I went out and sat on the front row there at his normal seats, and we were waiting for the entertainment to finish and wait for the announcement. I remember looking over at Clay, and I was with my son, and he was sitting there next to his wife, and I could just see his face. He was just, he didn't want to disappoint his fans and let his fans leave. I remember his wife was kind of rubbing his back and, you know, it was going to be okay to her husband, and he was very somber in the moment.
The announcement, of course, was that the game would not be played. And back at ESPN, host Scott Van Pelt and his crew scrambled to report the news and respond.
There's a moment where you, in your ear, your producer says, all right, the NBA has just suspended the season. The season is suspended. Woj is going to join us. And you're in your head, you're hearing that, and you're going, wait, what?
That NBA decision was just the start.
An unprecedented day in the world of sports, the coronavirus outbreak, bringing nearly every major sport or sporting event to a halt.
The NHL has suspended its season.
The NFL has canceled.
The ATP has announced a six-week suspension.
Major League Soccer is suspending its entire season.
MLB is expected to announce today they will be suspending all
operations. The NCAA is indeed canceling the men's and women's basketball tournament. It's not postponed. It will not happen this year.
March 11th, 2020, was the beginning of a new reality for everything, including sports. Here's a reflection from reporter Tom Rinaldi.
Right or wrong, sports have an ability to spark national conversation in ways that some other institutions no longer can, or maybe never have. We look to sports for something. Sometimes it's distraction. Sometimes it's passion. But sometimes it's leadership. That's what the NBA provided in this one moment.
You know, when you look at this night, that is what the NBA did. They were the first to address this pandemic head on. They were faced with a positive test. And they made a bold decision, and they did it knowing it would have huge repercussions for them, for all other sports. And ultimately, you know, a lot of us took our cue about how serious this was based on what the NBA did.
Julia Laurie Henderson is senior editorial producer for ESPN's 30 for 30 podcast, which includes the new episode March 11th, 2020. Julia, thank you so much for talking with us about this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, listeners have been answering our call for reflections on surviving 1 year of the pandemic, and we are amazed at the variety of responses. You've been telling us that you're spending more time in nature with your kids at home, and you're also reminiscing about the last big celebrations with friends, birthday parties, weddings, and recalling personal experiences with the disease itself. It's also clear that many people are experiencing moments of loneliness after spending months apart from their loved ones. Here and Now producer Sam Rafelson can relate to that. Here are some of her thoughts.
The moment I realized that my whole life was going to change was around this time last year. It was on March 12th, and it was my last day at work. I'm 28. I'm living the single life in DC, working at NPR, everything's great. And COVID happens. And I realize that, oh my God, there really is a deadly respiratory virus going around. And this is my worst fear realized. And even though I lived alone at the time and I felt like, you know, my whole world was being flipped upside down and I thought, you know, this is it. I'm truly alone. I don't have anyone. I realized quickly in the first couple weeks of lockdown that that wasn't true. All my friends rallied around me, virtually, of course, to tell me that everything was going to be okay. And my perspective on life changed. While I was afraid of the virus, I think at the same time, I was no longer living in fear of the future. I was excited for it, and I wanted to be here for it. As someone who's a very anxious person and very pessimistic, sometimes it's easy to think that things aren't going to turn out the way you want it to. But even while the world was collapsing all around me, I found myself feeling much more optimistic about where things were going. And I think that's because of all the support I had. And I realized, even in those early days of COVID, you know, walking into my studio apartment, thinking that I was alone, I realized that that couldn't be further from the truth.
Sam, we may be all remote, but it is true, you are not alone. That was our producer, Sam Rafelson. And now we want to hear from you. What are you thinking about 1 year after the pandemic began? How have you come together with others to persevere? Let us know by sending us an email to letters@hereandnow.org.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
Neuroscientist Kimberly Noble wants to know, if a family gets more money,
does it directly impact children's cognitive development?
Ideas about the brain. That's on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Health insurance is about to get cheaper for millions of Americans who buy their health care through the Affordable Care Act. The new coronavirus relief bill will expand tax credits for those buyers, making their insurance less expensive for a while, at least. Let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Mike, hi.
Hi, Peter.
So this is going to allow more Americans to qualify for subsidies when they buy health insurance on Obamacare exchanges. Could you explain more how this works?
Right. So the subsidies that currently exist sort of phase out as incomes go higher, and they stop completely for people who make more than 400% of the federal poverty level, which is about $51,000 a year for an individual. So what this does is, for one thing, it increases the subsidies for people at very low incomes that are below that threshold. But it also allows people who make above that 400% of the poverty level, it allows them to get some subsidies in the form of tax credits that will allow them to pay for their health insurance through the Obamacare marketplace.
How much are we talking about?
Quite a bit in some cases. The Congressional Budget Office gives a bunch of examples. But to cite one of the most extremes, they say, for example, if you're 64 years old and you make about $58,000 a year, your health insurance premium is about $13,000 a year, and you're currently not eligible for any subsidies. But under this plan, you get a subsidy of almost $8,000 a year, which would bring down your health care costs from $13,000 to below $5,000.
Wow.
So that's one of the more extreme examples, but they, you know, it goes to show the type of people that will greatly benefit from this.
That is pretty good. Now, the CBO also says the changes will cost about $34 billion and cover approximately 1.3 million more Americans. But it's only, Mike, according to this law, going to last for 2 years. So what do you think? I just wonder if there's going to be pressure then at the when it expires to keep it permanent.
Yeah, you know, I think it depends on how many people take advantage of this, how well the public becomes educated about this. And ultimately, it will all hinge on who controls Congress, likely, after the midterm elections next year, and sort of what the economic environment is and what the political tone is at that time. So very much, as has been said elsewhere, healthcare is very much on the ballot for the midterm elections again.
I mean, boy, you make a good point, because former President Donald Trump tried to dismantle the Affordable Care Act for essentially all 4 years he was in office. And now Joe Biden, who, of course, was in the Obama administration, is trying to build it back up again. So what do you think? I mean, this could mean something significant for the future of the law?
I think it potentially could. I think the more people who actually take part in the Obamacare health plan and use these exchanges to get their health insurance, the more people that are involved in it, I think the harder it's going to be to actually eliminate it. Historically, it has been a favorable program as far as the public polling. So the more people involved who are benefiting from it, I think the harder it's going to be to actually eliminate it.
And just briefly, Mike, do you know how people can find out if they qualify for some of these expanded tax credits or subsidies?
Yeah, so a lot of the information I got came from the CBO's website. Joe Biden has given a speech tonight on the entire stimulus package, and I imagine there'll be sort of a PR and educational campaign about this being rolled out soon after that.
No doubt. Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Country singer Brooke Eden is in love, and she wants the world to know. The tune you're hearing is her new single, Sunroof, which Eden describes as the promise of spring and summer after a cold winter. And we experience that in her new music video as she and her partner take a joyride in a candy apple-colored Mustang with palm trees and a beach in the background. It also reflects a part of her life as an LGBTQ woman that she was forced to stay silent about until now. Brooke Eden, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Great to have you. So this song, Sunroof, is about your relationship with your partner of 5 years, Hillary, a promotions director at your record label. Was it love at first sight?
I think that it was the most love at first sight that I could have ever imagined. I didn't believe in love at first sight, but it was just this overwhelming feeling of peace, like I exhaled. And that was about as close to love at first sight as I've ever felt.
Absolutely. And weeks after you two started dating, you broke this news to some industry folks and some people on your team as well. And that response wasn't what you hoped.
It wasn't. And actually, I didn't even get to break the news. I don't know if it was our chemistry. I'm not really sure, but they found out before we could tell them, which was even worse. It was just the beginning, and we were trying to figure out, you know, what we were going to do with this. And that was really difficult because they basically told us, if you want to keep your career, you need to keep this relationship hidden. And that was so, it was just the hardest thing that someone should ever not have to go through.
Right. As both a person and an artist, they're basically telling you to suppress who you are.
Absolutely.
And this secrecy was not only threatening your relationship, but it also threatened your health.
Yeah, I got really sick. And about maybe 2 years into our relationship, I was getting really sick before my shows. And I just didn't understand what was happening. The doctors didn't know what was happening. And finally, they found out that I had ulcers in my small intestine. And the only way that I could get rid of those ulcers was by getting off of the road, taking really good care of myself. And my body had to heal them. There was no magic pill to help to make them go away. So, yeah, when you're suppressing something that's such a huge part of who you are, and this is no normal love. I mean, this is the love of my life, and our love meant so much to me and was such a huge part of who I was. And just bottling that up every single day, I definitely think that that can cause health issues. And it's not healthy for your physical being, your emotional being, or your mental being.
This is the point where you decided, I've got to be true to myself and live my truth. What was the response to that? I mean, I know that for you personally, it felt liberating, but what about for those around you?
For the most part, I got a lot of love, because that was a few years in when I decided that we just couldn't do this anymore. And at that point, I think everyone knew this is no quote unquote phase. This is not two girls just having a good time. These are two humans who are madly in love with each other. And anyone around us who couldn't see that, I was just kind of like, you got to go anyways. You know, there's, if you can't see that this is love, then I don't know how to show it to you.
You've been speaking pretty candidly about this for a little while now. How have your fans responded?
It's been incredible. I mean, Hillary's gotten so many friend requests on social media because, yes, because, you know, I think they realize she's such a huge part of me. And there's a lot of new fans who see themselves in our relationship. But, you know, of course you have people who try to hide their homophobia behind Bible verses. And that's really hard. I grew up in a very religious household. I went to a Baptist school for 10 years of my life. And I grew up around that same hatred that I do not believe is God. I think that God is love. And I think that humans have interpreted his word in a really messed up, unhealthy way. But man, there are just some people out there who are so unhappy, and I'm not even mad at them. I'm just sad for them.
Mm. Well, this brings us to country music culture. Can we talk about that for a moment? You know, earlier this year, TJ Osborne, the lead vocalist for the country duo Brothers Osborne, came out publicly, and fans largely seemed to embrace him. But then there's something else. TMZ published this video of one of country's biggest stars, Morgan Wallen, using the N-word while outside of his home, and his label and talent agency dropped him. His music was suspended. And he's since apologized, but his digital sales soared as fans bought his music out of protest. What do these events to you say about the culture of country music right now?
Ooh, I mean, it's so hard because before all the Morgan stuff started to happen, I was seeing such a beautiful trajectory of where our genre was going. One of my best friends in Nashville is Mickey Guyton, who is a Black female artist. And she put out this incredible music last year. One of her songs is called Black Like Me. And it's mm-hmm. just the honesty within being a Black woman in America. And she's Grammy nominated in the country music genre. She has gotten, I always tell her she lives in LA right now. And I'm like, Mickey, you are the queen of Nashville. You don't realize this because you don't get to see all the billboards as you're driving down the Nashville roads. But there's a lot of Black artists that are coming to the forefront and getting a lot of attention and a lot of praise and a lot of support.
Yeah. So do you kind of see this as like two steps forward, one step back? I mean, it's sort of the country music industry is moving in a direction of being more inclusive, but maybe there's still work to do.
Oh, 100%. Yes. I definitely think it's two steps forward and one step back. And I just don't understand, because Morgan, he's had a few spouts even before he said the N-word that were just bad spouts. And he has said to his fans, like, I need this time to better myself as a human. And they just keep on buying the records. And so I don't understand it. I really don't understand it, but I do know that we're going in a better direction. It's just slowly.
Well, your fans are telling you so. I mean, there's so many things online where folks we're reading are saying, oh, you know, I see myself in Brooke. It's because of Brooke that now I can speak my truth and live proud. What is your advice for aspiring country artists who love the medium? They love this music. They want to be a part of it, but they may not fit in the traditional mold.
I would just say you got to keep on being you. Slowly but surely, there's not going to be a traditional mold anymore. We're creating this space that is open and free for everyone. And you just have to keep on doing you and putting your foot down and saying, this is who I am. And like I've learned, it took 5 years, but people will start to realize that authenticity is key. And as long as you're being yourself, that's when people are going to start to embrace you, is when you just be you.
Oh, Brooke, thank you so much for this conversation.
Oh my gosh, thank you. Also, your voice is just so calming. I just want to listen to you all day long.
Well, you can listen to me and I can listen to your music.
Oh, wow. Thank you. Ain't no way I can shut this
down. Ain't no way. Brooke Eden is a country music singer who's now sharing her love story with country music fans in the world through her music. Brooke was kind enough to give us a taste of her upcoming single, Got No Choice, which will be out soon.
Every year, between 15 and 32 million metric tons of rock salt are used to clear snow and ice from the nation's roads. Thing is, all that salt doesn't stay on the roads. Spring rains, which are on the way for many parts of the country, eventually wash the salt into rivers and streams, and that can quickly destroy freshwater ecosystems. Jesse Remedios from member station WBUR explains why this problem has no easy fix.
A 3-story tall gate creaks open and reveals a warehouse filled to the brim with light brown crystals. It's a mountain of rock salt.
We filled this shed this past week.
TJ Shea is what some might call a snow fighter. He's the superintendent of streets in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and it's his job to keep roads dry and safe all winter long, using this salt at the city's public works facility. There's more than 1,000 tons of it here, equal in weight to about 9 blue whales. But Shea says during a typical New England winter, it won't last long.
No, this is a couple storms worth, you know, depending on the event and the duration.
That's a lot of salt. And by the end of the season, almost all of it will end up in rivers and streams.
I'm not sure I would have known that many years ago.
That's Andy Hersina, a scientist with the Mystic River Watershed Association. He says road salt has toxic effects on freshwater ecosystems. It's been known to kill plants and animals in places like Wisconsin, Illinois, and Colorado. Today, he stands beneath a busy bridge on the snowy banks of Alewife Brook near Cambridge. The waterway flows into the Mystic River and then Boston Harbor. He's doing what he calls guerrilla water quality monitoring.
Watch your step.
Hersina hauls a cinder block connected to a digital water testing device out of the stream.
It's a little heavy.
He hooks it up to his laptop.
There's an optical port on this thing.
And checks out a graph that spit out almost immediately.
You can see this spike in the black lines.
The spike shows a huge rise in salt levels over the past 2 days, thanks to a rainy day earlier in the week that washed all the nearby road salt into the brook. Hersina has tracked salt levels here for a year now, and this is just another data point that he hopes will spark an important conversation.
Can we reduce in some smart, collective way the use of road salt?
Richard Chase works with the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection. He says we've known about the problem for more than a decade now, and salt reduction is a significant concern anywhere there is snow and ice, not just because of salt's impacts on aquatic plants and animals, but also because it can wind up in drinking water.
It's a problem that doesn't have easy solutions. It's not going away. We need to have safe roads.
Policy specialist Catherine Lang with the Massachusetts Rivers Alliance explains why there's no quick fix.
We don't have like an alternative that's fantastic and that we can use at scale. I think pilots are like a great option.
Pilot programs, like one in Cambridge, that uses a brine mix of water and salt purified in the sun, instead of that mountain of rock salt I mentioned earlier.
We are saving salt, we're saving resources, we're saving our environment.
That's TJ Shea again, the snow fighter. Shea stores his brine in massive water tanks just outside the rock salt warehouse. Brine works the same way as the rock salt. Trucks pour it on the road before a storm, and then it melts snow as it hits the ground. But brine uses a quarter less salt than the standard rock salt. That's a big environmental benefit. And
it's obviously a lot cheaper of a product. We make it ourselves, so the savings that way.
Shea started using brine in 2019 after seeing its success in nearby towns. A rural county in Wisconsin has also experimented with a liquid cheese brine to de-ice roadways. Vermont's transportation agency also uses liquid salt. This year, Shea de-iced a third of streets in Cambridge using his salt and water mixture. He hopes to raise that number to 100%, but he needs more trucks equipped to spray the brine. Until then, when the snow falls, residents will continue to hear the familiar crunch of salt on a hard surface. For Here and Now, I'm Jesse Remedios.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.